choice. Mr. T's mug had a blue police emblem on it. He took a sip and placed it on his kitchen table and asked me if I wanted Earl Grey or Orange Pekoe. Doesn't matter, I answered. I wondered why he'd called me over to his house for a chat. He'd never done that before. Phoned my grandparents' house and asked me over. I thought maybe Brian was sick, or worse, that Mr. T had heard at police headquarters some of the stuff I'd been involved with lately, him being the deputy chief of a police division and all. He plopped a bag of Orange Pekoe in my cup, poured in some boiling water, and then gave it to me. The bag drifted around, releasing a stain that was more brown than orange. He took a seat across from me and slid a stoneware container of sugar my way. I helped myself. Jesse, he began, I know you're a good kid. I added another lump to my tea and thought, Ma, here we go. I had a hard time not rolling my eyes. Since the time you stole our robin's eggs, I knew you had it rough. Orphan, no mom and dad. He took a sip and continued. I grew up without a father. My mother did it all on her own. He pulled a leather photo album that was older than dirt from the counter next to him and opened it. See, here, that's me. He pointed to a picture of a guy around my age doing a layup shot. The picture was black and white, and in it, he was clean-cut, thin, and athletic with hairy legs. The socks and shorts he was wearing were both too high to be fashionable. There were other basketball pictures and a photo of him and a woman he said was his mother outside an old tenement building. She had on a long trench coat, and he told me how she used it to smuggle him into their building as a child because single mothers were looked down upon back then. I found basketball on the force, he said, and closed the album. It saved my life. I poured a bit of milk into my cup and the tea churned in a gray tornado. My poor mother, he went on, she just couldn't show me how to be a man. I was uneasy hearing Mr. T speak this way. It was the most any adult had spoken to me in months. I started to respond, but he lifted his hands slightly off the table and said, just listen, please, and then planted his elbows down in front of him. I gave my teacup a turn. I wasn't ready for a lecture. Brian lit my cigarette with his Zippo and asked me to watch for the ashes because they could burn the upholstery of his new car, a used Renault he got from his parents for his 17th birthday. I have something cool to show you, he said as he pulled into the parking lot of the local park. He turned his headlights off, hopped out, and grabbed some beers from the trunk. I got out, and we both sat on a bench. See here? Brian held out one hand. His fingers peeled back to reveal his silver Zippo. Yeah, so? And in this hand, he held up his other hand, I have the car keys. I want you to pick. I reached for the beers and yanked one off the rings. I want one of these. Fuck your lighter and keys. I laughed and pulled the tab, and it hissed open. I took a swig and belched. No, serious, bro. Pick. It's a lesson I learned at Landmark. Landmark was a series of empowerment workshops his uncle had gotten him for Christmas the year before. After he'd attended a few sessions, Brian would spout off about how we had to face ourselves, how we had to live our best lives, and how truth was subjective because everyone's truth is true or some shit like that. None of us really paid attention to it. Easy, Socrates, I said. Can't we just drink without all your philosophy bullshit? I really hoped my comment would diffuse his little life lesson, but he persisted. Pick, lighter or keys? There's only one right answer. If I must, keys. Why? Explain why. What the fuck you mean, explain? Tell me why you chose that over the lighter. I don't know. Because it can drive away in it? I took another swig, the beer fizzing in my throat. Wrong, he yelled, sounding like a game show host. Pick again. I was confused, but gave it another go. Okay, I pick the lighter this time. Explain why. Brian flicked the Zippo and it twirled around in his knuckles, like a leprechaun twirling a gold coin. I snatched it from him. "Because you said the keys were wrong, and I need this lighter for this blunt." I pulled out the joint I had in my pack of smokes and lit it with the Zippo. I took a big toke, thinking I had the right answer this time. No, wrong again. "Fuck this game, yo." I took another huge drag and passed the joint over, but Brian declined. He really wanted me to keep guessing. So I did for about 10 goes, till I had enough of his stupid game. "I asked you to choose the lighter or keys, and you rightfully chose one or the other, like I asked." He put the lighter and keys on the bench between us and cracked a beer. "And when I asked you to explain why you chose it, you said something about how you'd use it, or how it looked, how you could drive it, light it, its color, anything. That's wrong." The weed hit me and I got really interested in what he was saying. "Then, what's the right answer?" "The right answer is that you chose because you chose. That's it. All the explanations you gave to justify your choice are just excuses your mind made up after the fact." A gong bonged over my head. I couldn't tell if it was the beer I drank or the kush I'd smoked, or the power of his crackerjack philosophy. "So that's the big reveal?" I said. "I chose it because I chose?" "Yeah. And when you know that, you can just choose to do anything you want." "Get the fuck out of here," I said. I grabbed another beer, flicked my ash on the grass, and stared up at the stars. There'd been too many lectures lately, not enough talking with me, but it seemed Mr. T was determined to give me another. "Love is an important thing," he said, "and I don't see that in your life too much." His words lingered around the ceiling fixture, then crept down the walls into my brain. How dare he? My fists clenched around the teacup and near scalded under the pressure of my grip. "I take Brian to basketball, to soccer, to canoe in Algonquin Park, and I help him with his paper route. I do it because I love him. He's my son." The words dropped like a cold stone in my belly. I remembered all the times Mr. T had invited me to attend Brian's soccer and basketball games, and how I went out with them on Sundays to deliver newspapers. He'd always included me throughout the years, bought me snacks at Brian's games when we cheered him on from the sidelines, taught me how to shoot a jump shot when he taught Brian, showed me how to study for 1 hour a day, and told me how that added up and made the world of difference in Brian's reading. I searched my mind for any recollection of my grandfather making time for me like that, but couldn't remember anything except work. There was never any hockey or basketball practice for me and my brothers. No swimming lessons, no canoe trips in the woods, no paper routes, no study time, no interest. We did go to judo for a few months when I was 10, but that was because we got beat up so badly at school, and he rarely stayed to watch us practice. And there were our yearly Cape Breton vacations. But that was mainly about Grandpa, his lobster, and drinking, not us boys. Then I thought of my father and wanted to run away. Mr. T dropped another sugar cube in his tea and stirred slowly. "For me," he finally said. "It all changed when I realized I had choice. Choice is the human ability to go one way or the other." He opened the album again, but this time to a picture of when he must have been in his 30s in a police uniform around when I first met him. His wife was beside him with little Brian in front. He paused a second, then turned until he landed on an older photo of himself in what appeared to be his early 20s, taking a shot on a billiards table. He slammed his finger onto the photo, and I flinched at the force of it. I was a hustler, Jesse. Was good at it, too. Thought it was all I was worth. He turned the album upright and pushed it towards me, knocking into my tea. It was a great photo. His hair was greased back, and the bottom of the jeans were rolled up, exposing ankle socks and loafers. He looked cool. "I had to make a choice," he said. "Live this way?" He flipped to the police pictures, "or live this way?" He flipped back to the greaser photo. "So how did you do it?" I asked, truly curious. I realized it was all on me, and no one could save me, not Mom or anyone. I had to choose to do the work of bettering myself, just like I chose to hustle in pool halls all day. It was that simple. Mr. T scratched his chin and admired himself in the pool hall shot. I thought he'd offer me more wisdom, but he offered me more tea. Premonition. There goes Josh with his feather and that shit he keeps burning and waving everywhere, I said to Leroy and my friends out in the high school smoking pit. Rows of yellow school buses hid us from the view of the teachers who routinely scanned the parking lot for students doing drugs. We blazed about 3 joints and got away scot-free, as always. "What is it?" Leroy asked, as he put the roach in his cigarette pack with the rest of the day's smoked roaches. "I don't know, some Indian herbs or something like that, sage." I flicked my after-joint cigarette and watched it ricochet off the ground, sending burnt ash into the air. I smacked my lips and the taste of cheap cigarettes mingled with the smooth, expensive flavor of Afghan blonde hash. Who the fuck knows? As long as Tonto ain't waving it at me, he's gone Indian, just like my other brother. I rolled my eyes and popped my jean jacket collar, even as I wondered, what was it? Leroy laughed and agreed that my brother looked ridiculous. Later that same week, I was surprised to see Josh come out of the side door of the school. I was skipping off like I always did, but Josh was such a goody two-shoes. Why wasn't he in class like he always was? "Hey, Josh," I yelled from the smoking pit. "Get to class, you brown noser." Me and my stoner friends giggled as I took another pull of the hash joint. When my toke was finished, I looked up at Josh, but he didn't respond. "He looks like he's crying," one of the girls, Sarah, said. "Why?" "What? Josh don't cry. He's a beast," Leroy said, his eyes bloodshot and nearly closed. Leroy was correct. My brother was a beast. He was 240 pounds in grade 11 and had shattered the long-standing bench press and leg press records at our school. He was also one of the biggest and fastest rugby players in the district and struck fear in the hearts of many of his opponents. He could also fight better than anyone at our school if he got pissed off enough, but he had a gentleness about him and only fought when provoked. "No, seriously, Jesse, he's crying." Just as Sarah finished saying that, I saw one of the teachers, Mrs. M, burst out the side door. She tried to grab Josh from behind, but he collapsed on the ground before she could reach him. I dropped my empty book bag and ran to his side. "What's wrong, yo? Josh, what's wrong?" When he looked up, I saw his eyes were wide and red. He mustered, unable to catch his breath. "You..." "Back up," Mrs. M said with the force of a lioness. "Something happened in class and he needs air." I was confused. Had someone died? Had someone said something hurtful to him? Had someone done this? I saw you, he said. "I had a vision and it was horror." A scrum of teachers came out of nowhere and pushed me aside before he could finish his thought. They sat him up and kept anyone, including me, from talking with him. An ambulance came. High off my tree, I soon lost interest and turned my back on him, drifting over to my friends in the smoking pit. "What the hell happened?" Leroy asked. "I don't know. He said something about a vision, like he's a mystic Indian or something." Leroy and the gang snickered and talked about the feathers we'd seen Josh with earlier. "You're all right, though, Jess," Leroy added. "Yeah, you're not into that Indian shit. I remember at public school when you used to say you were Italian," someone else said and laughed some more. I joined in. Berries. It was the house party of the century, and in walked a young girl with a Tupperware container. "Does anyone want muffins?" she asked, her mouth full of braces. I was sitting by the fireplace, sucking on a cigarette, and watched the guys in the gang make fun of her. But she persisted, bubbly and friendly, walking around the room. She offered me a muffin. I took it and just stared at her. Her smile was angelic despite the dental hardware. As I ate the best blueberry muffin of my life, I was perplexed by the taste, by our encounter, by everything. There were lots of other girls there, but this odd girl with the muffins captivated me. I mean, who does that? Who brings baked goods to a party with piles of cocaine, weed, and speed? She was like a walking loaf of wholesome Wonder Bread amid a torrent of hard candy. That pure goodness attracted me to her. I followed her into the kitchen, introduced myself, and asked for another muffin. "Sure," she said and gave me the largest one, blueberries popping out all over. The music in the house was pounding louder than a rock concert, and when she handed it to me, I had a hard time hearing, but she batted her eyes. They were huge and blue. I almost dropped the muffin. "Thank you," I said, trying to figure out what she was all about. "Any time," she mouthed. Icebergs cracked and fell away inside of me. A month later, we were going steady and were in love. Her name was Karen, and she was 18, old for those braces. I was afraid to tell Karen I was half Native at first, but she said, "I think it's wonderful. You should be proud of who you are." I just about cried. When Karen took me home to meet her family, I got to talking with her father, and he told me that they were Scottish and Dutch and had settled near Toronto after the Toronto Purchase of 1805 between the British Crown and Mississauga Indians. Their family received a swath of land that they'd farmed ever since. Karen had worked on the family farm since she was young, and she was comfortable doing manual labor. We had that in common. And when I told Mr. A about my Scottish side, he asked me all sorts of questions, and I could tell he was really interested, just as Karen was, even though I couldn't answer most of them. He was even more interested when I told him about my native family. He wondered if I was still in touch with anyone. "I read up on history quite a bit about Canada, the prairies," he said, "and I'm curious. Do you know if your mother's people were Cree or Métis? If they hunted bison? You said you were from Saskatchewan, right?" "Yes, she's from there, but I wish I knew more, Mr. A," I said. "She wasn't really around to tell me about that stuff." The three of us decided to go canoeing one day down the Credit River. It was the end of March and the ice had almost thawed. I sat at the back of the canoe, Karen in the middle, and Mr. A was up front. The river ran fast underneath us, bending wildly down twists and turns. Shelves of ice broke off as our bow slammed headfirst into them. I wasn't good at steering and couldn't get the craft to turn when I wanted it to. There were spots on straightaways where it seemed I knew what I was doing, but they always gave way to turbulence when we hit a bend. Karen still cheered me on and held on to the sides, laughing and sending up clouds of frozen breath in front of me. But it was hard to deny. I was shit at canoeing. Mr. A, though, knew what he was doing and tried to compensate, pulling us forward with his paddle and powerful farmer's arms. "Watch the corner," I heard him yell as we hurled into a sharp turn. I thrust my paddle into the water and we broadsided the bank. The canoe shifted, Karen's blonde hair flew in the wind, and the winter water slammed into my chest. My ribs ached as I drifted down and down. My arms and legs quickly became heavy and lethargic. I gasped twice and sucked in mouthfuls of water. The heavy cotton and wool of my winter clothing tangled around my body like dead weight as I settled onto the riverbed. I saw a paddle drift by. I screamed for help, releasing a muffled burst of bubbles, then silence. I noticed the lock of Karen's hair swaying gently like seaweed as her body writhed above me, the current pulling her downstream in the frozen water. Her movements were slow and getting slower. Her leg kicked and her boot came loose. I don't know what came over me then or how I managed to shift myself, but I ripped off my jacket, kicked off my boots, and swam upward. In a few strokes, I was with her. She was already above water, though, gasping for air. She grabbed my arm and pulled me to shore, where we collapsed beside one another. We shivered and held each other for warmth. She smiled, then her expression froze. "Where's my father?" she asked. "I don't know," I said. I raised my head and right away saw him laughing about 20 feet downshore. "That's how I know you love each other," he shouted and waved. "You didn't even think of dear old dad." Karen and I went everywhere together. "You're always with that girl," Leroy complained. "You're never around anymore." It was true. We had busy schedules, and spending time with Leroy interfered with my time with Karen. I worked nights after school, and Karen helped on the farm until I finished at around 10 p.m. Then she would pick me up in one of her father's old trucks. It smelled like cow shit, but I didn't mind. It was our love shack on wheels. We'd drive out into the country and talk until dawn, or we'd take off to a rave together and dance until our legs just about fell off. When the beat dropped and she was grooving right there in front of me, with a huge smile beaming light and love, I was so free and happy. Opening up. The side door of Karen's truck was open, letting in the cool midnight breeze. We lay side by side on the seat, heads hanging out, staring up at the sky. We were parked out front of my old elementary school, where Leroy and I had thrown gum in Sylvia's hair. Our friends had wanted to drink and cause pandemonium, as usual. We just wanted quiet in each other's company. There was a stillness between us, broken only by the rustle of leaves in the wind. "Look at that one," I said as I pointed to the North Star. "That's the star Indians used to hunt by. They'd follow it and know where to go." I let the mystic nature of my comment linger in the night air. "Bullshit," Karen said. She laughed, but I could tell she was halfway convinced. I took a drag of my cigarette and blew the smoke up and watched it dissipate. The stars grew lighter the longer I stared. Karen shifted. "Move, you beast, my arm is asleep." She giggled and pushed me over to the gas pedal, right where the scent of cow shit was strongest. I gasped and held my throat, and we both laughed, then wiggled out of the truck. "Once we are settled on a nice spot on the grass next to the playground," Karen said, "can I ask you something?" "Sure, shoot." I wrapped my arm around her shoulder. "You never talk about why you live with your grandparents." She picked a blade of grass and twirled it. It was odd for her not to look me in the eye. I searched for the right words. There'd never been boundaries between Karen and me, and I wanted to tell her the truth. Sometimes life just tears people from one another. That happened with my family when I was young. I paused and sat up so Karen would look at me, and she did. Dad had lots of issues, drugs and violence and other things. A million years of silence followed. Stars flickered and extinguished one by one. Civilizations rose and fell. Great pyramids were built and crumbled. Yet she kept looking at me. And the wall, 1,000 miles high that I kept between me and the rest of the world, didn't exist. Not a brick anywhere in sight. Memories of Josh peeing himself by the bathroom, the hornet by the tub, and the sweet smell of Saskatoon berries along the road allowance with my mushroom and cook'em filled my soul. As did the blue bruises along my mother's face. I breathed in and exhaled the rest of my truth. Mom had to do what she had to do. I looked up and saw a comet soar by and fall off into the horizon. I thought of Mom standing in front of the mountains in the Polaroid and wondered where she was. When she left, it all fell apart. Karen pulled me close. "I understand," she said. She reached up and knocked off my baseball cap. I was staying out of trouble for the first time in my life. I stopped stealing and lying and had saved up lots of cash, around $5,000. I was taking care of my health too, cutting back on drugs and alcohol. My grandparents saw the change in me and came to like Karen, even more than when they first met her. I would chance to say that they even came to love her. They asked her over for dinner every other week, and she always came, blueberry muffins in hand. Grandpa loved those muffins almost as much as I did, and sometimes he'd pick them over Grandma's butter tarts. Grandma didn't like that, but she still had a soft spot for Karen. Grandpa even sat me down one afternoon and said that if I broke her heart, he'd find me and neuter me. "You do not find girls like her every day," he said. "She's special." I should have listened to the old man. Pride. I cleared the sleep out of my eyes. It was 5:45 a.m., and Grandpa was driving me to my morning shift at the grocery store. My head pounded, the sour smell of whiskey strong on my breath, the after effects of a buddy's birthday. It was a reasonable enough occasion to fall off the wagon. "Grandpa," I announced, "I want to buy a car." He rolled down his driver's side window and the cold morning air hit my face. "You will not," he barked. "But you taught Josh how to drive at 16, and I'm 19 now, and you never taught me." He turned on the Hank Williams song on the radio as we rounded the corner and gunned it. It looked like we entered warp speed as we hit a wall of snowflakes illuminated by the headlights. "You're wild. Always were. You'll kill yourself driving drunk." I heard the wheels squeal. "But..." "I said no." He pounded the steering wheel. I thought the column might break under the force. I kicked my feet and muttered out my window. "I work hard. It's my fucking money." I'd never sworn in front of the old man before, and I recoiled as soon as the words left my mouth. He slammed on the brakes, and the load in the back of the van shifted. "If I ever catch you talking like that again," he said, "I'll snap your neck." I went to the bank ATM and withdrew the last $2,000 I'd saved. The wad was thick in my hand as I looked at the receipt. Zero. It was all gone. Leroy waited in the car, jungle music pounding, weed smoke pouring out the window. It was our last stop on the way to the rave. I'd run through my savings in little under 2 months since the argument with Grandpa, buying everyone drinks, smokes, and endless amounts of drugs. Destroying my future was my way of getting back at the old man. "Jesse, please," Karen had pleaded. "How are you going to afford college now?" "College? Are you fucking kidding me? I got kicked out of school last semester." I never believed post-secondary education was attainable for me, like it was for my friends, whose parents had saved for their education since they were born. Getting kicked out of school and having a car denied me were the final straws. "Don't talk to me about school, Karen," I hissed. "You're rich. It's different for you." She looked stunned, but I was furious. Leroy and the other guys never questioned me about my spending. I tried to avoid her after that. "Wicked," Leroy said as he opened the passenger side door of his father's Pontiac 6000. I was waving around my cash like Diamond Jim, the last of the Gilded Age big spenders. "Let's get there before the line gets too big," I said and hopped in. I lost Leroy 2 hours into the party. I'd picked up a bag of Purple E's and a couple ounces of weed from one of my dealers when I first arrived, and kept it in my front jean jacket pocket with my roll of money while I tripped about. The E's were so strong, I had a difficult time training my eyes on anything for more than a few seconds, so it was inevitable I'd lose him. Every 6 hours, I dosed another E and puffed another joint, hoping Leroy would show up. The rhythm of the ragga jungle pounded through me as the night wore on. I danced myself into a deep trance. My throat burned with thirst as sweat poured down my face and neck. I must have drunk 10 bottles of water. My sneakers darted nimble on the slick floor, and I grooved with speed like a hummingbird. Shouts and cheers roared with each move, and soon a circle formed around me. Women in miniskirts, combat gear, and baseball hats, B-boys and B-girls breakdancing in Adidas tracksuits, and dudes with their shirts off pumping their fists in the air, and a horde of other ravers blowing their whistles to the beat. They all looked as high as me. I closed my eyes and kept dancing harder and faster with everyone, the drugs now completely in control of my body and mind. There was a silence that came over my spirit, followed by what sounded like a gust of wind. The noise of the rave receded into the background, and I heard something emerge from deep inside my core. My eyes pressed shut. I focused inward on that sound. There was a distant drum, louder, louder, louder still, until it vibrated every molecule in my being. The beautiful cry of Indian drummers rang aloud in every direction, from the north, south, east, west, up, down, over, under, within, and without. I opened my eyes and saw I was dancing alone on the flatness of the great plains. I was dressed in a plume of feathers, deerskins, a bustle, beads, moccasins, a rattle, and tassels. My legs rushed in perfect coordination over top of the grass, pressing and tamping it down, as vast fields undulated before me. The sun hung low as red clouds of dust were kicked up by my feet, filling the air. I danced and danced, moving this way and that, until my thirst for water and the rave seemed but distant memories of a life I once lived. Only the blinding morning warehouse lights snapped me out of my trance. The music turned to half power, throbbing some mix of breakbeats and house. My jacket, my money, my drugs, and most of the rave attendees were gone, and my white muscle shirt had spots of blood, the size of cookies on it. There was one girl standing next to me, her eyes as wide as some starry universe. The bottoms of her pants were grim and black with cigarette ash and trampled innocence. "How long have we been dancing?" I asked, disoriented and shaky. 2 days, she said. Her jaw muscles flexed and clenched as she continued to gyrate, glow sticks dim in both hands. She pointed to the blood stains. "That happened to me once." I peered inside my shirt and saw the ends of my nipples were open wounds, like they'd been hit with a belt sander. "Rub them raw against my shirt," she added. "Happens to marathon runners, too." I never did find Leroy. Banana Split. A woman named Sue showed up at my work one night. "Call me," she mouthed, holding a banana to her ear like she was on the phone. I was stacking Florida oranges near the lettuce wet case. She put the banana down and pointed to it, then glided towards the cashier to pay for her groceries. I walked over and saw that she had scrawled her number on the side of a banana and had planted a bright red lipstick kiss over top. "That's creative," I thought. Sue hung around with some of the guys I partied with. She was nice-looking, around my age, and had her own car, but I'd never spoken with her before. I placed the banana in my pocket and went to the back room and got busy with the rest of my work. I never called. A few weeks after the banana incident, my buddy Jeff was having a house party since his father was away on business. "No girlfriends," he ordered. "Just bring booze and drugs." "Roger that," I said. I asked Karen if it was okay for me to go. "It'll give you a chance to hang out with your girlfriends," I said. She was more than happy to do that. When I got to Jeff's, the windows were rattling to a bassline so loud I thought they might shatter when the beat dropped. One of my buddies was spinning the turntables. People were grooving in the kitchen and living room, and I saw a few people out back giving each other massages in the hot tub. I could tell everyone was high on coke and E by the size of their pupils and how confident they were in their conversations. There were a couple of girls I'd never seen before, but Sue was there. She came over right away. "Why didn't you call me?" I didn't know what to say. "No worries," she said. Her jaw was grinding and I knew it must be from a recently consumed E. She disappeared into the kitchen and reemerged with a beer and placed it in front of me as I took my shoes off. "My little produce boy," she tapped my bum. I jumped and smiled awkwardly, then moseyed my way over to my friends. Sue melted into the crowd. By 4 a.m., I was blitzed off my face and out back trying to cool down. The drugs were super powerful. My skin was goosebumped and sensitive to the touch, and my hair stood on end. I gulped a mouthful of water, poured the rest over my head, and sat down on a garden bench to let the night breeze do its work. Sue appeared from around the garage and sat next to me. It was clear she was tripping hard, her eyes two pools of India ink. She nudged close and ran her fingers up my spine and through my wet hair, sending shock waves of pleasure to my toes. Before I knew it, we were upstairs in bed together. When I emerged from the bedroom, I was ashamed, because I'd betrayed Karen. She was the one person who loved and trusted me, the only person I'd ever opened up to. I didn't talk to anyone as I put my shoes on, gathered my things, and caught a taxi back to Brampton. When I got home, Grandma was up. She handed me a note from Karen, asking me to call so we could have brunch that morning, and asked, "What's wrong, Jesse? You don't look well." I couldn't look her in the eye. "Nothing," I said, pulling away. I dropped my hoodie and went to call Karen. She answered, "Hi, baby." Her voice so sweet I almost died. Without a pause, I said, "Karen, it's over. I'm breaking up with you." There was no noise at first, then a terrible, "No." She said it over and over, then started saying, why? I could hear her crying. I'd never heard someone cry like that before. I swear I heard her heart break right then. I was so ashamed, and I couldn't even tell her why it was over. I hung up and tried to catch my breath. Grandma cracked the door and came into my bedroom with soft, moccasined steps. "You're making a big mistake," she said. "Karen's a wonderful girl." She shook her head and placed my hoodie on the dresser. A little baggie of Coke tumbled onto the carpet near her foot. I looked down and she gasped. She knew instantly what it was. "Searle," she called, panic in her voice. "You better come up." He rushed upstairs. When he saw the bag, he yelled, "You're a fucking asshole, just like Sonny. To shit all over love like that?" I backed up into the corner. "Pack your things. You can't stay here anymore." I saw how hurt the old man was and tried to speak. But? "No, you knew the rules." I realized then that he'd meant what he said all along about drugs. I remember leaving that night with my stuff in four black garbage bags, frightened of what the future held. I remember a week later losing my job at the grocery store. I remember catching a ride out west with one of my buddies. I remember asking Josh if I could stay with him. The rest is a blur. The Stolen Streets, 1997 to 2008. Windigo. The long, dark winter is ever-consuming. Defrost the cold hunger with fire, water, and skin. Meat is scarce on the trap line, but still, I hunt these alleys. My fingers claw at the glass and peel away the label. I imagine icy northern lakes abundant with pike, but these fish escape me too. Starvation sets in. Breath freezes in January's wind. Lost and alone, wandering. I swill back the pain. It burns and it belches, rage and despair, leaving only a Windigo who cannibalizes himself. Adrift. Leroy drove down Hastings Street looking for a safe place to park. He'd come out west a few weeks after I did. He just showed up looking all desperate with no money, just his father's Pontiac 6000. Josh took pity on him and let him crash on his couch until he found a job. But things went south fast, 2 days fast, as they often did when we were together. Rain doused the windshield, and the wipers moaned back and forth, the friction hypnotizing me. Gray clouds obstructed the sky above. It had been raining since I'd arrived a month earlier, and I wondered if the city ever saw blue skies or the warmth of the winter sun, or if the mountains that ringed Vancouver were only a myth. I had a hard time believing they were there. Hordes of homeless junkies slinked down the street, their skin grayer than the clouds in concrete cityscape. They moved like zombies, half-dead, lurching, and hungry. One bag lady pulled down her pants and pissed right there on the side of the road. No one seemed to care. But Leroy laughed. "What the fuck?" he said. "Where are we?" I tried to laugh, but a feeling of dread came over me as she lost her balance and fell over in her own urine. A scrum of people congregated on the corner of Main and Hastings. They darted their heads about, and I knew they must be engaged in some sort of drug deal. One of the men yelled and shook his fist, clutching something. His voice was guttural. It sounded torn to shreds, like he just drank a bottle of Drano. His clothes hung off his body, more rags than anything. Another man hollered and the group pounced, arms and legs flailing wildly. The rough-voiced man was consumed by the swarm of violence. I rolled down my window to get a better look and the group scattered, leaving him prostrate on the sidewalk. "Where the fuck are we is right," I said, squinting to see if he was still breathing. I noticed a pool of blood spreading near his face, a blankness across his eyes. He looked dead. But they all appeared dead in their own way, and the majority of them looked Indian. I'd never seen so many Indians in one spot before, except when I was a kid. I'd also never seen such squalor and despair. In suburban Brampton, places like this didn't exist. "We've got to pick a spot soon," Leroy said. "We're going to blow through all the gas and we ain't got no money left." His left leg was bouncing up and down and he kept glancing in and adjusting the rear view mirror. I chewed my knuckle down to the flesh. Josh hadn't warned us of any of this when he kicked us out. "I should arrest you both," he screamed. He'd come home early one night from his shift and found me and Leroy smoking pot. "I'm fucking RCMP. What's everyone going to think?" He charged into the room and wheel-kicked my face, sending the joint flying and an explosion of ash and embers into the air. He moved like a black belt after years of taekwondo. Leroy cowered beside me on the couch. It never really dawned on me that my older brother was an officer of the law and that I shouldn't be getting high at his place. Even his red Mountie uniform hadn't convinced me. To me, he was just Josh. I acted as I always did, stealing his clothes and disrespecting him like the little brother I was. I even nicked his badge on occasion and went around telling everyone I was a cop so I could get on public transit free of charge, pick up chicks, and eat complimentary meals at local restaurants after I assured them that I'd protect them personally. When Josh found out, he wanted to arrest me for impersonating an officer, but I talked my way out of it somehow. But stupid me, I kept pushing the limit. No wonder he went Jackie Chan on me for the pot. Leroy pulled into a lot near a river and turned the car off. The engine sputtered, followed by a hiss and a cloud of steam from under the hood. I thought it was the radiator. Leroy reached into the glove box and pulled out a map of the lower mainland that I'd pinched at a gas station. "This car isn't in good shape," he said as he spread the map out across the dash. "I borrowed it before my dad had the chance to get it serviced." "I heard him yell at you when you phoned home last week. He sounded upset that you borrowed it." Leroy glared at me. I thought he might hit me. But he furrowed his brow and busied himself with the map. I kept pressing. "You must have done something pretty serious." I waited for his answer, but he ignored me. He turned over the ignition and it clicked a few times. The interior lights dimmed and flickered, then went black. The car battery was dead. That much I knew. We were stranded. "Fuck!" Leroy yelled, his voice raising high. I decided not to inquire further about the trouble he'd fled. "Where are we?" I asked, surveying for street signs. I could make out a couple, plus there was a huge white bridge off to the left. I grabbed the map and searched, trying to pinpoint our locale. Leroy stared out his window and lit one of our last smokes. "Here we are," I said. "New Westminster. And that's the Fraser River. I think that's the Patullo Bridge." I glanced over to see Leroy was crying. He turned his head when he noticed me. "Yeah," I said, peering out over the river. "At least we found a good spot." By the third day, food had become a major problem. Every store we went into had floorwalkers who followed Leroy and me whenever we tried to steal even one bag of ramen noodles. We figured it was because of all the addicts who tried to do the same. Stores in BC had way better security than out east. I got caught at the Army Navy and was issued a promise to appear by a policeman, which I tore up the instant I got released. "We've got to think of something quick," Leroy said as I emerged. "I'm literally starving." I examined his face. His eyes were sunken and the metallic sweet smell of starvation wafted off his breath. The taste on my tongue told me that I emitted the same odor. Leroy's solution was to call home. We ducked into a nearby phone booth and he went first. "Hi, Dad," he said. "I need help. I'm homeless in Vancouver and have no food." He sounded pitiful. I could hear his father's voice booming. Leroy's shoulders slumped and he hung up. "He told me to figure it out on my own. You try." I dialed home. It rang a few times before someone picked up. "You have a collect call from Jesse Thistle," the automatic operator voice said. The line clicked and my grandmother answered. "Jesse?" she said. "Don't ever call here again." "But Grandma!" "No. Your grandfather was clear. You're not welcome." I couldn't believe what she was saying. "But I'm starving." "No. You're on your own now. This isn't your home anymore." Her voice was shaky, like it was when Yorkie died, and she'd bawled in the kitchen. I heard my grandfather's gravel yell in the background. "Is that the asshole?" There was a muffled sound, then his voice blasted in my ear. "Don't ever call here. Don't ever come here. Don't even think of here. Josh told me what happened. You're not part of this family." He slammed the receiver into the cradle. I slid down the side of the phone booth and hid my face in my knees. Leroy didn't say a word. The second week, sleeping in the car with no food, I started to panic. Home would never be there again for me. Nor would Karen. I still loved her beyond words. The dual losses were like my rudder had snapped off, without warning. I was adrift somewhere in the middle of the ocean, and there was no search party coming. Sleep was impossible. I was overheating even when I took my clothes off and kept the car windows down in the 0 Celsius winter air. Leroy complained of the same intense heat. One of the local street kids told us we were overheating because we were in ketoacidosis. Our bodies were too acidic and were digesting themselves, muscles and all. "You could die from that," he said, and that it was impossible to steal in Vancouver because we looked like starving crackheads, like all the street people. "It didn't help that I was Indian," he added. The kid's name was Troy. Leroy got along with him right away and invited him to stay with us in our car. To my dread, Troy slept in the back seat with me, a space already too cramped. Dude smelled like a sewer. And when I complained, he said I smelled even worse. I found that hard to believe. Troy knew more about the streets than we did. He was like Leroy and had never spoken about what he'd done. I knew not to ask. The other good thing he brought was his knowledge of where to sell stuff, clothes primarily. He had a connection at a local pawn shop. I'd purchased stylish stuff with my produce job money, and piece by piece we sold my clothes and bought food. It lasted maybe 3 weeks until I had nothing but one t-shirt I wore, a pair of pants, my sneakers, and a Canada soccer jersey. Troy introduced us to job agencies and check cashing places, two things I didn't even know existed, and were always the first, along with the other immigrants and newcomers, at the job agency counter at 5 a.m. to get general labor jobs. We dug ditches, packed shipping containers, moved furniture, and whatever other shitty hard tasks other Canadians didn't want to do. When we got our checks, $25 each for 8 to 10 hours, we'd cash them in. To work like a slave only to have the temp agency take half, Leroy complained, counting out his dough and eating our regular bag of fast food. Then the check place gouges us even more? Where's the security? That's how it is for young guys with no education in Canada, Troy said. They made it this way, our greedy parents. Next, all the jobs will be temp. We soon learned of a better spot where we could get picked up and toil for the day for better money. The work was much more dangerous, moving heavy cabinets that weighed nearly 1,000 pounds each and took 4 men to move. When Troy lost his grip and one came crashing down on me on a stairway, I quit on the spot. We never did get paid for that. We moved on to demolitions of old homes. We got no masks, respirators, or protective gear of any kind. At the end of one day, after weeks ripping down plaster walls at various different places, my chest hurt. I coughed into a tissue and noticed a splash of blood and some yellow stuff that looked like booger cornflakes. The immigrants I worked with said they coughed it too, said it was from all the asbestos. "What's asbestos?" I asked. No one told me. At the end of 3 weeks, the job was done, but the employer didn't show up. We didn't get paid. That was tough. We were trying our hardest, but we were getting ripped off, getting little sleep, rest, or comfort in the car, and we were still wasting away. Soon we gave up getting up for work and just sat in the car. Leroy began to cough at night. Troy, too. Grayish phlegm that smelled like dirty honey shot out all over, and they both got a rash that spread up their necks and over their lips and face, red, bumpy, with peeling scales. Leroy didn't look right. The emaciated skin over his face started to appear translucent. His green veins turned a bluish purple, his eyes pressed way back into his bones till they looked like they rested on the front of his brain. When he smiled, his dimples folded into 100 tiny creases, like he was centuries old and had lived in the desert all his life. Troy coughed on me a couple times. I never got as sick as they did, but a few weeks later my hair began falling out in clumps, and so did theirs, like shedding cats in spring. The cap on my front tooth broke off. It took a brittle piece of bone under my nose with it, leaving me with a gray and black jagged tooth smile. I never realized how important my smile was until then. The loss seemed to suck the joy out of interacting with anyone, more than even the starving situation did. I just couldn't smile without feeling horrible about my already disheveled appearance. I stopped smiling altogether. End of a friendship. Leroy and I went out begging. Troy had fled the week before, down to the east side, where there were food banks, churches, and shelter beds. But there were also all those zombies and hard drugs, and street people were dying there. We decided never to venture down there. We had a difficult enough time staying alive where we were. We'd been homeless for just over 4 months and were barely hanging on. We returned to the car defeated with no money to find the back window shattered, glass peppered all over my sleeping spot. Night was falling and it was particularly cold for May. The intense heat of ketoacidosis had given way to an intense chill. I cleaned the glass away and tried to go to sleep, but my spine and hips were bending and shattering like layers of ice smashing up on a lakeshore. I prayed for morning and the sun to warm me. I waited and waited. When the light started appearing on the horizon, I sat up and peered out over the Fraser River. A bunch of logs drifted by, the movement rhythmic and silent, as they floated off to their destination. I looked down at Leroy, his torso tucked under the steering wheel and legs stretched across the front seats. I knew then that it wasn't my place to stay in the car anymore. I don't know how I knew, but I did. Maybe it was the thought of my mortality that pulled me away. Or maybe I didn't know anything other than abandonment, one of the earliest lessons my dad had left me with. Childhood memories of my times with Leroy filled me as the sun crested up over the mountains and called for me to let go of our friendship. I'd earned the sunlight. It was mine, and mine alone. I crept out of the car and shut the door gently, careful not to wake him. As I rounded the corner of the parking lot onto the street, I looked back at the car and saw Leroy's head appear, turn side to side, then disappear back down. Perhaps he thought I'd gone to the washroom. I said goodbye in my heart and wished him well, and then made my way to the Trans-Canada Highway for the long hitchhike back home to Ontario. Rougarou. I hitched home in early spring. The mountains, then prairies, swollen lakes, the thickness of forest, all was uneventful. But on the Trans-Canada Highway, somewhere east of the prairies, I was picked up by some farm boys around my age. They said I looked rough and wanted to feed me, to give me a place to rest. So in their car I went. We drove some distance off the main route, down some obscure dirt road, far out of the way, to an abandoned building. I smelled smoke when I got out. A loon called in the distance. The driver was kind and asked me to carve my name on a tree. There were other names carved in, too. Other hitchhikers, they said. Others running, trying to get home. As my blade cut into the trunk, I felt a fist slam into the back of my head. Stars upon stars. I didn't see it coming. One boy tackled me and tried to bring me to the ground. But my thick skull and strong spirit, they held me up. I staggered and stumbled, arms outstretched, trying to regain my senses. I ran disoriented into the forest toward where I hoped the highway was. Warm blood poured out my head. It wasn't a fist they hit me with, I figured. It must have been a rock or a hammer. They stalked close behind me through the brush. I ran with all my might, my chest burning and legs barely under me, weakened by months of no food. I almost gave in. But my relatives, the trees, saw my trouble. "Hide with us, nephew," they rustled. "Our leaves will darken their way." Their branches bent and covered my passage. They arched over to save me. Deeper into the poplars, cedars, and oaks I fled, a good 3 miles. My attackers' footsteps fell silent, their voices trailed off. In time, I chanced upon good old Highway 1. It felt safe, like some mighty river of asphalt that had the current to carry me home. I stood there all night with my thumb out, begging to be picked up. I waved my arms at each passing vehicle, but no one stopped or even slowed down. Never the same. "That girl dancing near the bass bin is fine," Rex said as he tilted his rum and coke towards the stage of the nightclub. I barely had my legs under me, still reeling from the long hitchhike to Toronto and malnutrition. When I got back home, friends commented that I looked like I was dying of starvation. Some were afraid to talk to me. Perhaps they just didn't want to think about how far my addictions had taken me, or that they were headed there too. "She fine," I agreed. But my eyes were more interested in Rex's drink than the girl, its ice glistening with each strobe of the lights. House music shook the empty glasses splayed out over the bar, left there by a bartender who, I knew, was too busy doing rails of coke to properly serve customers. Rex had a hell of a time getting his first drink, yelling 4 or 5 times before he finally got her attention. My stomach growled. a mixture of hunger and cravings. The memory of the taste of whiskey welled up, reminding me I had no money and no business being in a club. "I love this song," Rex said, pumping his hand in the air. The DJ had mixed in the latest track from Chicago, the mecca of house music, and Rex, in his excitement, spilled some of his drink on the man in front of us. Neither noticed. I watched and waited for the ecstasy pill I'd taken to kick in. I lived for that Chicago sound, an amalgam of gritty 4-4 house beats, old-school funk, and gospel lyrics. No one did it better. No one. "I'm waiting for my E to kick in," I hollered over to Rex, trying to be heard over top of the throbbing bass line. "Can you buy me a drink?" The beat finally dropped and the crowd went wild, asses gyrating everywhere. "Can you spot me for a drink?" I yelled one more time. Rex didn't hear and continued to thrust his drink in the air, watering the crowd in front of him. I tried again. "Bro," I yelled and grabbed his arm. "I'm fucking dying over here. I need a drink." Rex turned to me and said, "You should have said something sooner." His jaw chattering, his pupils wide open. His E had taken effect. Lucky bastard, I thought. I wondered why I wasn't feeling anything. "Hey," he screamed over to the bartender, "give me 2 rum and cokes." She heard him right away and fired 2 tumblers down the bar. Rex dropped a $20 bill on the bar and she snatched it up without offering any change. He handed me my drink. "Cheers," he said, and we clinked our glasses together and looked out over the crowd of gorgeous women. I again noticed the woman near the bass bin. She was beautiful. My belly warmed as the rum settled under my ribs, sending a rush of ecstasy up my spine. A swell of spectacular pins and needles broke over top of my scalp. My eyelids fluttered, and I braced myself against the bar, waiting for the impending tsunami of rapture. My knees buckled. "There he goes," Rex said. His eyes looked like a shark's right before the kill, completely black. I tried to smile back at him, but my jaw took on a life of its own, chattering up and down. It was goody, the best kind. The kind that slams into your gut and impregnates you with a cloud of migrating monarchs, fluttering your intestines into a writhing swarm of uncontrollable pleasure. We'd scored our ease earlier from our dealer, a trustworthy guy named Island. He sold primarily to the underground gay clubs on Church Street that always had the best drugs and newest music. My friends had found that out early on. That's how we met Island, and that's how we got as high as fuck on $40 ease. Most other dealers sold ease at $10 or $20, but they weren't really methylene dioxymethamphetamine, MDMA. Just a mix of cheap crystal meth, caffeine, and maybe a little heroin for euphoric effect. But Island took care of us proper. "These E's are killer," Rex said. He placed his empty glass on the bar, then rifled through his pockets. I thought he was going to give me another pill, but he pulled out a wad of bills, leafed off $40, and handed it to me. "I know you're broke. I'm just glad you're here, safe. Not hitchhiking across the country, starving and shit." I took the money, at a loss for words. I could barely make out Rex's face. The visual vibration was so jarring. "I love you, dude," I said. The words gurgled up out of my throat in a moment of euphoria. I'd heard them, but hadn't wanted to say them. Sweat poured down my face, dripped off my chin. "I know that guy," Rex said as he wiped my face. "We're brothers. One love." He dapped my hand as the throb of house music picked up. "We did love each other. It was a camaraderie, a closeness, a fellowship. A connection with the universe that's hard to explain, but that happens with E. Almost like you turn into Jesus, Gandhi, and Mother Teresa all rolled into one. Not a problem in the world, caring for all things at once, a connection you never forget and always yearn for after you've sobered up. And when you mix it with sex, it was even more powerful. "Listen," Rex said as he grabbed my hand and pulled me back from total ecstasy. Someone's page and I gotta go over to Spadina. Meet me there at 4 a.m. He slapped my cheek to get my attention. I retrained my sights on his face, but had trouble focusing. He was melting, blurring, fading into another dimension. A wall of color filled my vision, a kaleidoscope of disco ball refractions. He was somewhere in there. Yeah, got it. Buzz. See you there. I held on to the bar for dear life. His shape was coming in clearer, but still wasn't quite there yet. I ordered another drink for you, Rex said before leaving. It should be along shortly. He winked at the bartender and she fired another rum and coke down the bar. It landed in front of me, leaving tracers in its wake. I needed toothpicks to prop my eyes open, and my stomach flipped as the liquid splashed and swirled down. Was there something different about these e-pills? Or was it the drink I'd left unattended in my stupor? It was hard to tell. My feet were two hot air balloons floating high above the Paris fairgrounds, simultaneously lighter than air and heavier than the compressed core of a star for 20 minutes after Rex left. Finding purchase on the ground was nearly impossible. Flashes of black blinded me as I stumbled forward onto the dance floor. I pleaded for help. The other partiers just backed away and shot me expressions of disgust. I stumbled and fell, dropping my drink, the tumbler shattering. My mind was confused, groggy, dark. I thought maybe if I found some coke or speed, I might be able to perk up, shake off whatever was happening. I thought I saw Island near the stage and so made my way towards it. I staggered, zigzagging, as far as the basement where the beautiful girl was dancing, then collapsed. When I awoke, I was on the other side of the club near the washrooms, some 40 feet away. The floor was still packed, the music was louder, people were dancing faster, and the bar was closed but decorated with drunk girls giving strip shows, and everyone was way more fucked up. I was still disoriented. As I pushed myself up the wall off the floor, I noticed that my belt was undone and my pants were open and hanging off my waist. My underwear was gone. I knew I'd be wearing underwear when I got to the club. There was a deep pain in my intestines, radiating from my rectum, down across my testicles and penis. I panicked and hobbled over to the washroom into one of the stalls. I wadded up a pad of toilet paper and wiped it across my anus. A dark stain of fresh blood appeared on it. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I ran my fingers over my bum and discovered that I had what appeared to be hemorrhoids. I tried pushing them in, but they hurt more than anything I'd ever experienced. I touched them gently again. I'd never had hemorrhoids before, or whatever these were. I tried to understand what had happened. Who was around me before I fell unconscious, why I woke up near the washrooms, or why what appeared to be my intestines were hanging out of my bum. I can't remember how I got home, or even where I actually went. There was nothing but a dense black fog in my memory. I saw nothing but darkness, confusion. A deep feeling of shame shrouded my soul. A gust of molecules. The phone ringing pierced the night calm. I rolled off the couch and went into the kitchen to pick it up. It was Uncle Ralph. Jesse, go get Ronald. The urgency in his voice was unnerving. I ran to Uncle Ron's room, Solomon, my uncle's Rhodesian Ridgeback, trotting behind me to investigate the commotion. Ralph's on the phone, I said as I pushed on Uncle Ron's foot. Wake up. He shifted and squinted at the alarm clock, 3:40 a.m., then shot out of bed and ran into the kitchen. What's wrong? He barked into the receiver. He cleared the sleep from his eyes and waved me away. Everything okay? I moved to the sunroom to eavesdrop, but could only hear the static of Ralph's voice and Uncle Ron's, I stared out the window at the treetops bending in the nighttime wind, and hoped the call wasn't about Grandma or Grandpa. Uncle Ron said, I'll be right there, and then hung up and bolted out to the car without a word. I watched the car's taillights disappear into the darkness. I placed a chair next to the window. My adrenaline would keep me awake. Solomon sat by my side. Uncle Ron had been living in Port Hope with his daughter, who was just 16, since she started getting into trouble in Toronto. He figured she'd stay out of trouble out in the country. I thought it was a smart move on his part. I'd been with them for 5 months. Uncle Ron got word that I was sleeping at the airport and couch surfing with friends, slipping further into addiction. The assault at the club left me struggling, grabbing nothing but sand. One never thinks it will happen to them until it does. You're never the same and it's always there. I had managed to sober up while I'd been in Port Hope with Uncle Ron, somehow. But I was still smoking weed, trying to sort through everything that had happened. Uncle Ron represented safety to me, even though I couldn't bring myself to tell him what had happened. At 7:30 a.m. the next day, Uncle Ron pulled back into the driveway. I was still staring out the window after downing pot after pot of coffee and smoking cigarette after cigarette. My teeth buzzed like I'd eaten a hive of bees. Uncle Ron slumped over the steering wheel. The car was still running, but the car stereo was off, and he always drove with 70s rock blaring. He got out of the car and made his way to the house. I heard the grind of gravel with each step. I poured a cup of coffee and left it on the table. The floorboards creaked as he found his way upstairs and sat down. It appeared he'd been crying, which was odd to me, since he was so powerful, so full of male bravado. I didn't know he could cry. I was afraid to ask what happened and went back to the sunroom to my chair by the window. A stand of trees caught my eye, the tops of the birch branches dancing in the wind, the sun tangled up in their rusty leaves. The clink of Uncle Ron's spoon against the side of his mug sounded like a chorus of sledgehammers striking railway ties. He cleared his throat and asked me to join him. "I don't know how to say it," he said, not looking at me. Another oddity. I pulled up a chair to the table, as silent as I could be. "Grandma got a call last night," he began, "from 22 Division in Etobicoke. The police picked up a homeless man last night. He said his name was Ron Thistle, but that's me. The homeless guy knew everything about me, my birth date, what hospital I was born in, my arrest record, everything about Grandma and Grandpa, my siblings' names and birth dates." Uncle Ron pulled a joint from his pack of smokes and lit it, careful not to singe his hair. He took a moment before he spoke. "Grandma told them I was out here in Port Hope." He released a cloud of smoke into the air, then broke into a fit of coughing and handed the spliff my way. "We had that between us, weed as a balm to dull the sharp edges of the world, weed as a crutch against addiction." I took a huge draw and held it in, my attention focused on him. "Mom knew it was Sonny, your dad," he said. "Mother's intuition." I passed the joint back and waited for him to finish. "Only Sonny knows all my stuff," he said. His eyes were a little redder now. It was hard to tell if it was the weed. I watched a tendril of white smoke twist from the head of the blunt. It reminded me of when Uncle Ron took me out on collections back when I was a kid. I pictured us in his red convertible singing and bopping our heads as he smoked weed. I didn't know then that that was what he was smoking. An image of my dad begging out on Young Street came to me, his hands and mine slowed by winter lethargy, his clothes loose and hanging off his wasted body. I thought of Vancouver, of Leroy's car, of the Fraser River, of sleeping with nowhere to go. Uncle Ron rolled the end of the joint in the bottom of the glass ashtray, knocking off the excess ash, and handed it back to me. It sat idle in my index and middle fingers, digits yellowed from constant use. "Mom phoned Ralph because he's a cop," Uncle Ron said. "She wanted him to identify the man at 22, but he couldn't leave work, so he called me." I flicked the joint and watched the ember glow red. I kept looking down, afraid of what Uncle Ron would say next. He reached over and grabbed my free hand. They let the guy go before I could get there. His voice wavered. I could feel my hand going numb. The officer said it was because of shift change. They clear the drunks out of the bullpen at 5 a.m. Before the day officers come in, I got there at 5:15, 15 minutes too late. I'm so sorry, Jess. I tried to follow Uncle Ron's words, but it was as if his lips were moving in slow motion. Dad was gone. He didn't care enough to stay. He didn't want to come back home. Nothing mattered. It was as if an atomic blast followed. The stands of the trees sucked forward, then blown back with such force they were obliterated. The citizens of Port Hope were vaporized into carbon imprints on the broken cityscape. An old man walking with his cane, a mother holding her baby, a little girl playing in the park. All were transformed into shadows of daily life atomically scorched onto the concrete of sidewalks and roadways, and I was now one of these shadow people. I gazed down at my hand and saw nothing but Uncle Ron grasping a carbon handprint fused onto the table's surface. It's pointless, I thought. My destruction's complete. The next week, I left Port Hope and began drifting again.